In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The traditional view of the birth of modern science places it firmly in the age of the so-called scientific revolution in the 17th century, with men like Sir Francis Bacon, René Descartes, Isaac Newton, and Galileo. Here we're told we see the rise of empiricism and the development of the scientific method, the creation of institutions to support scientific work, and discoveries like gravity, heliocentrism, and the circulation of the blood that laid the foundation for subjects that would go on to become physics, astronomy, and biology. But what if we drew back and looked not just for the great men of change offered to us by the 17th century, but the ones who paved the way for their revelations, at the places that facilitated their discoveries, at the forms of technology and types of collaboration that created the environment in which intellectual innovation could occur? What, in other words, is the prehistory of the scientific revolution? When did the birth of science really occur? Today's guest suggests that we need to shift our focus a century earlier to the places and people, including women, who drew the blueprints for scientific work. She is Violet Mueller, award-winning author of The Map of Knowledge, whose new book, Inside the Stargazer's Palace, The Transformation of Science in 16th Century Northern Europe, takes us from the icy Danish observatory of Tycho Brahe to the obsidian mirror of Dr. John Dee. Join us as we venture into the mysterious world in which modern science began. Dr. Violet Mueller, welcome to Not Just the Tudors.
Thank you so much for having me on.
It is a delight and a privilege to talk to you about your forthcoming book, Inside the Stargazer's Palace, which I have read and thoroughly enjoyed. And what's so interesting about this is it completely reformulates our idea of when science happened, as it were. I mean, this book is the kind of prequel to the birth of science that we normally hear. It's not about the narrative of great men in the 17th century. This is a 16th century odyssey, and it takes us to places rather than just focusing on people. What led you to take this approach, and why does it matter that we hear these other stories?
Thank you. I think it matters because I think it's very reductive to only focus on the history of science through the prism of what turned out to be a successful idea. And I think it is a much richer and more interesting story if we look at the whole progress of it. And this idea that science is this march forwards towards enlightenment, it's just really not true. There were always these funny little cul-de-sacs that people went down. And I think if you miss all that out, you just only see a very small part of the story. And I think the 16th century is particularly interesting. It was a very complicated period. And I think that's partly why, in terms of the history of science, it's rather jumped over, because it's very difficult to fit it into the narrative. And I think for people in our age, there was so much that was going on that has been discounted since that makes it nonsensical. But it's so interesting. I think it was a really incredible century.
Yes, that's interesting what you say there. There is this sense that one of the things that people struggle with when you talk to them about beliefs in the 16th century is that there wasn't the separation of fields of knowledge, that astrology and medicine were intertwined. There's no hard barrier between what came to be called science and what came to be called superstition. You know, you've got Tycho Brahe in this book, the great astronomer, believing in the influence of stars on the human organs. How do you think we should grapple with this? How should we handle this integration of knowledge in the period?
I think you have to try and leave behind, and obviously this is an extremely difficult thing to do, and I guess it's what historians are always trying to do, escape your own paradigm and just be very accepting and very open. And I think that's actually essential to studying any period of history, because the past, it was different. And that's one of the reasons why we're so fascinated by it. And I have been challenged countless times also with regards to my previous book, The Map of Knowledge, where people say, why is it interesting if these ideas didn't turn out to be true and valid, and if they are now not part of the scientific canon, why is it interesting to study them? But I think it is, because without making those mistakes, we wouldn't be where we are now. And also, a lot of what we think we know now, especially about the cosmos and astronomy, will be completely and utterly refuted in years to come. This happens all the time. This is an essential part of the way that science works. So it still happens today, and I think, therefore, it's completely vital that we're able to do it when we're thinking about what people believed in the past.
Yes, that makes total sense. Fundamentally, to be interested in the ways in which knowledge did not go, that did not prove to be the route forward, is to be interested in the scientific method, isn't it? It's all about experimentation.
Exactly, and how people thought about things and how they found things out. For me, the process is as interesting as the result. And I think that's why I wanted to focus on places, because this is a sort of relatively new area in the history of science. It was traditionally very much, as you said, about ideas, but actually looking at the sort of material conditions in which these ideas were produced is very important and very interesting. So that's what I wanted to try and achieve in this book. It is more difficult because the evidence that's left behind for descriptions of what the laboratories looked like and what equipment they were using and that kind of thing is harder to find. So it's a more difficult job. You have to be quite broad and look at lots of different sources of evidence. But I like that kind of history. I like that sort of building up a picture using lots of different bits of things rather than just focusing on one important text which one scientist wrote.
Well, let's turn then to the study of places. You look at seven places in this book, and the first one is 15th century Nuremberg. What was it about Nuremberg in the late 15th century that facilitated the creation of a new world of knowledge?
Nuremberg became very early on a big centre of craft and making. So there were people there who moved out of their villages and they moved to Nuremberg, and they were expert goldsmiths, clockmakers, all these really vital craft activities that were carried out in an atmosphere where they were really protected. They had guilds, it was very well organized, and the city developed this absolutely unsurpassed reputation for excellence. So if you wanted to buy a machine that really worked, that was really well designed, Nuremberg was the place to go and get it. And of course, it's a very quick, vicious circle that happens. It gets a name and then more people come and attracts all the most talented craftsmen in that period. And that's where you get the astronomer who I talk about, Regiomontanus, who goes there, and he specifically says, I've come to make my home in this city because I can get hold of these instruments. And I think we have to remember that in this period, you couldn't just go to a shop and buy an astrolabe or even a measure rule or anything. You had to order it, or you had to make it yourself. There weren't places where they could just go and buy this stuff. So it was a much more complicated process than it is today or has been since. You needed people who were physically capable of doing this, of making these kind of things. And Nuremberg became this sort of serendipitous centre for that. And it's so sad because when you hear the name of Nuremberg, that's not what you think about, obviously. Of course, you think about the terrible things that happened there in the 20th century. So yes, I wanted to rehabilitate Nuremberg's early golden age.
And one of the things you say is that other than necessary ingredient was money, patronage-powered culture. What was the role of the Fugger family in Nuremberg during this time?
They were actually from Augsburg, but they were this absolutely extraordinary dynasty. They were the sort of northern version of the Medicis. And they managed to create wealth. And I think still today, if you translate their wealth and compare it, they are up there with Jeff Bezos and people like that. They were just unbelievably clever. They were also lucky because Jakob, who was the first member of the family to really get things going, he happened to be around at a time when copper production was ramping up massively, metal production in all these different places in Germany and what's now the Czech Republic. And he was just the right man at the right time. And he would lend local noblemen money because everyone was always broke. And they would then repay him in the rights to the silver from the mine. So he just was able to put himself right in the centre and ended up lending the equivalent of millions and millions of pounds to pretty much every royal house in Europe, and in particular, the Habsburgs. So they funded the patronage of the nobility, but then they were also patrons in their own right.
Now, you mentioned the importance of craft, this sense of having to create the instruments in order to do the intellectual work. And this is a theme, I suppose, that carries on into your next place. What was happening there in the early 16th century?
Louvain sort of took over from Nuremberg when it came to making these specialist mathematical instruments. And that was just simply that there was a combination of people who were studying there. There was a very important university in the city. And I think that's one of the things that really I find so fascinating when you look back at the past, and you have it in terms of art and all sorts of things where you just get this moment in time when you get the right combination of people in the right place and they work together and something incredible happens. And this was definitely the case in Louvain in the early 16th century, because a man called Gerard Mercator was studying under another man called Gemma Frisius, and together they revolutionized making maps, obviously globes, and also all sorts of other mathematical instruments. And it's interesting that Frisius was a doctor, he was part of the university, and he taught maths on the side. So he had this sort of unofficial, and I think that's quite a common theme in this period. The universities are really important places where people meet, but they're not studying these subjects at the universities. If you wanted to study the forefront of science, you couldn't learn that at a university. So they would gather in these informal groups in their houses, in their workshops, and that was where the sort of magic happened, basically.
Yes, yeah, so that sense of collaboration informally leading to progress, leading to new ideas, seems really important here. I was really struck by the fact that Louvain in this time, though, was a theologically dangerous place. You know, the terrible story you tell of the women being buried alive because they don't believe in transubstantiation. It made me think that it's also a kind of dangerous place to be conjuring up new ideas.
Yes, absolutely. And the whole story, once you get to 1518, 1519, and the Reformation has begun, it's the backdrop to all of these stories. And it actually, the growth of Protestantism had a really transformative effect on these scientific communities, because they were the kind of people in a town who were attracted by this new religion, especially in the Low Countries in this period. It was the merchants and the educated craftspeople who were the early adopters of Lutheranism. And of course, then as the Habsburgs, who were ruling that whole area at that time, tried to stamp out Protestantism. And there was these awful stories where this group in Louvain was caught and arrested, and then they actually did bury some of the women alive, I think in the marketplace even. But of course, this then meant that there was immigration. So a lot of these people fled and went elsewhere. And I talk about this a little bit later in the book, but quite a lot of these communities of people went to England and settled in London, which was itself becoming Protestant. So it did have a very interesting effect on pushing these cutting edge technologies to different places. And I think that's a sort of fascinating aspect of the story, if you look at how science developed in Northern Europe at this time. And that's really the sort of underlying story that I'm telling is how science became established in Protestant Northern Europe in the 16th century.
Yes, that's a fascinating parallel or perhaps causative element in terms of the environment of Protestantism and these progressive ideas. Do you feel those two things are fundamentally interlinked, or is this a coincidence of geography, for example?
I think in some ways they are, but that's not to say that there weren't huge numbers of Catholics doing extremely important scientific research. And there are lots of other factors involved, the biggest one being, of course, the discovery and then settlement and exploitation of what they called the New World, so the Americas and Africa and India. So that was all part of this story, but I think that you can't discount the importance of Protestantism in terms of formulating a new identity and giving impetus to people. They wanted their religion to be the most successful, because there was always this feeling that if you were successful, whether it was in battle or in commerce or whatever it was, that meant that your type of religion, whether it was Islam or Catholicism or Lutheranism, you were right and God was on your side. And that was really important. So it is part of this much bigger story. But of course, I'm definitely not saying that there weren't very important Catholic scientists, because there were.
Yes, obviously your book makes clear the complicated economic and political circumstances in which these developments are happening. Let's follow some of those emigrants to England now and catch up with the figure that many people will have heard of, Dr. John Dee, and his library at Mortlake near Richmond. And what was so striking to me from your work on Dee was this sense of having to create a centre of learning not only in the absence of official structures, but quite often despite the officials. You know, why do you think he was able to do this and to create this library that predates the great libraries of Cambridge and Oxford?
I don't know. He's a really extraordinary man. And I must admit now that I did my PhD thesis on his library. That's what I studied. John Dee and I have been, I feel, close companions for many years. And I find him a very confounding person because he's infuriating. And I mean, I'm sure if you met him, you would have felt like throttling him quite quickly, because in some ways he was so arrogant. I don't think he was very good at reading a room. That was one of the reasons why he was never as successful as his early career suggested that he might have been. But he was also just this amazing person who had this vision, and he had no money, but he collected the first universal library in this country in terms of scope, and also one of the first properly universal libraries since the ancient world, really. He was interested in everything. And he wrote a catalogue of his books before he left for Poland in 1583. He went for this long trip, which I talk about later in the book, to the continent, because he's basically exhausted all his avenues in Elizabethan London. So you can see the books that he owned. And there's just this wonderful bibliographic edition that was made in, I think, 1992 by these two fantastic bibliographic scholars. And they make an index of subject matter. And it goes on for about five pages, because he just had books on everything and created this sort of unofficial research centre, really, where people, it was right on the Thames. So people would drop in all the time on their way from Richmond into Whitehall or wherever they were going. And it was a really pivotal place in Elizabethan London. It was really important. And sadly, Dee, he just wasn't very good at playing the game. And I think obtaining patronage at the Elizabethan court was difficult. Basically, she's very good at making promises, but not so good at keeping them. And he really struggled financially. And then he had all these children and a wife, and the house was always full of scholars who were staying over. And it was just this sort of extraordinary place.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Today, writers are expected also to be speakers and to have to go and do a range of public events. And that isn't always easy for a writer. And I feel that kind of parallel for Dee, the need to find patronage, but the need also for scholarly solitude and seclusion. And as you say, that means that in the end, it is very difficult for him to progress because he needs money to do the work. And I wonder, actually, I mean, this is a complete tangent, but I wonder if we're into a kind of place in our history where that's becoming a problem again. I mean, scientists have scientific labs, but more and more scholars are independent. We're both independent scholars having this conversation. And it's a challenging situation in which scholarly research is produced.
Definitely. And I think also for Dee, when he started, he always had his books, but then he had laboratories. It sounds like he had a sort of couple of sheds in the garden where he was doing alchemical experiments. But then, of course, he later in life got very obsessed with scrying, which involved this man called Edward Kelly, who claimed to be able to speak to angels, and they would sit at a table with a crystal ball, what Dee called his showstone, and Kelly would declaim from what the angels were saying to him. And there's an incident in Dee's diary where he describes someone comes in unannounced and just opens the door of the study, and there they are doing this, what, you know, was considered by some people to be an extremely dangerous and possibly diabolical activity. So yes, the sort of dichotomy of needing to be accessible to people and to be seen and be a person at the Elizabethan court, and then the dichotomy of needing to do the secret work, was something that he really did struggle with. It was a real problem for him.
Fascinatingly, though, as you say, it's his reputation for magic that means his papers survive. I hadn't ever put that together before. It's really interesting that it's that intense focus on the esoteric work that he's doing that means that we know about his scientific research.
Yeah, absolutely. And this absolute obsession that he might have got hold of some kind of higher knowledge. It's possible. And then you get people like Elias Ashmole in the following century, the sort of decades after Dee has died, literally going to the field in Mortlake where his house was and digging up the field in order to try and find things. The sort of historiography of Dee's legacy is one of the most fascinating things about him. And then, of course, later on, he gets taken over by this really unsavoury person called Aleister Crowley, who was a Satanist, basically. So Dee's afterlives are every bit as fascinating as his actual life was.
So we're heading back to Germany as the next place on our tour of 16th century scientific Europe. And we're going to talk about a man whose work is little known, especially in the Anglophone world. Can you talk to me about the work in Kassel that anticipated many of the developments in science that we associate with people like Francis Bacon and René Descartes?
Yes, trying to get the name of Wilhelm IV out into the world is one of my main aims with writing this book, because he was this absolutely extraordinary man. And there isn't really even very much about him in Germany that I found, and even in Kassel, where he lived. He's one of those people who has fallen down the crack of time in the history of science, which is a great shame, because he was a really interesting character and he did make huge contributions towards making astronomical observations more accurate, and in particular using clocks rather than trying to measure. So they would use time rather than measuring the distance between the heavenly bodies. And there's really nothing written about him in English apart from one American historian who wrote about him early on in his career. But apart from that, there was very little I could find on Wilhelm, and his name should be known. And he was obviously in communication. Dee went and visited him at Kassel, and he was also in close communication with Tycho Brahe, and Brahe also visited him in his palace. And I don't think he had a sort of specific observatory which he had built, but he had lots of instruments and he would keep them on the balconies of his palace, and then the servants would have to move them across to a different balcony when he needed to see a different part of the sky. And this is something we see again and again throughout the history of science. When you get a ruler who is personally really passionate about a particular subject, that's when you really see progress, because they obviously put their heart and soul into it. And Wilhelm designed astronomical clocks himself and popularized them. And he was a very important ruler in Germany at that time, which was made up of lots and lots of these little principalities. And they all looked to Wilhelm for inspiration and also for political leadership, because early on, when he was a very young man, his father was taken prisoner as part of the battles that were going on between the Habsburgs and the Lutherans. And he had sort of become the regent for quite a long time, and when he was really very young. And he developed this reputation for being very good at getting people together. He was very moderate, very intelligent, very thoughtful. And so they looked up to him in all different ways, and they all ordered his clocks. They all wanted one of his astronomical clocks for their collections. And he was in contact with all of these astronomers. There was this widespread community of astronomers at this time, and that was another thing I really wanted to bring across in this book, because, again, I think that's not at all well known, but how there was really a scientific community for the first time across Europe, and they were all writing each other letters, and they would then copy the letters and pass them on. That then turned into what we now call academic journals, because it was a way of presenting your research and your findings and then getting it peer-reviewed effectively. So Wilhelm was so important, and of course he was right there in the centre of Germany, in the centre of Europe. So Kassel was a sort of major hub on this network of scientists.
I love the way that you're drawing attention to these places that haven't been on the map of scientific importance, but now should be. You mentioned that he was visited by Tycho Brahe, and our next place, a little Scandinavian island, is really all about Brahe, but it's also about, as you've already said, the importance of rulers, and here it's Frederick II. And one thing I wanted to ask you about with regard to the kind of world-class astronomical research institute that Brahe establishes with Frederick's help, do you feel that the Scandinavian culture of egalitarianism was crucial to making that a success? That seemed to come through.
I don't know. Maybe I should be a bit hesitant about making claims like that. But I lived in Denmark for 6 years. My husband is Danish. So I do feel like I have a bit of an insight into Danish culture. And they are different from us in that way. There's this weird Scandinavian thing called Jantelov. It's basically, you shouldn't ever think that you're better than anyone. And I think that's quite different from our society, which seems to be much more hierarchical, and the class system and all of that kind of thing. I don't know enough about Danish social history, but definitely if you look at Brahe, and he was literally born into the grandest Danish family, and all of his relations were advisors to the king, and all of the families, that his mother's family and his father's family, they were all the absolute creme de la creme of Danish society. And he was extremely arrogant, and he treated people really badly sometimes. But he did also have this sort of egalitarianism, insofar as he was also interested in geography and the weather and all sorts of things. If you were interested in those things and you were talented, he wanted you. he had this sort of side to him. And I don't know if that was because he was Danish. He married this woman. They had a tradition at that time in Denmark of a morganatic marriage. So if you were an aristocrat and you wanted to marry someone who was from a lower class than you, further down the social order, you had what was called a morganatic marriage. And it meant that your children couldn't inherit any of your property, and they did have his surname, but it was a sort of half marriage. And that was the life that Tycho chose. He didn't want the life of an aristocrat. He didn't want to spend his time running his estates and hunting and at court having banquets and that kind of thing. He was a complex person, and I think there were sides to him where he was very arrogant, but also sides to him where he was egalitarian.
And people will know his discovery of 1577, the comet. One thing that struck me, though, is the sense that it didn't really lead to immediate intellectual change.
No. Everyone knows about Copernicus, and that was many years before, in 1543, when the book was published, where the Copernican system was put out into the world. But it took decades for that idea to be processed, to be accepted. And I think the next generation of astronomers, including Brahe and Wilhelm and Dee and all of them, they were all obviously very much aware of his book and had read it. And this was the period when everyone was looking at the sky and saying, OK, is it right? Can it really be true that the Earth isn't at the centre of the universe? Because that was quite a big deal to accept. And then there was this series of astronomical events which really brought the attention to astronomers and really gave them something to all discuss. And this was the first moment, certainly in the post-antique world, where we see a group of people, they're all seeing the same thing in the sky, and then they're writing down their observations and they're writing to each other and they're rationalizing. What could it be? What does this mean? And so there was the supernova of 1572, and then there was the comet of 1577, and then there's this grand conjunction in the early 1580s. And these things really bring astronomy to the fore when it comes to research and really got people talking. And we can see this in the huge number of pamphlets and leaflets and letters that are then written, and books about these events, where you can see everyone is trying to work out what is going on. And they're letting go of the idea which had stood for millennia, Aristotle's idea that the cosmos was made up of these crystal spheres nested within one another. It was such a beautiful idea, but obviously it couldn't be true. If suddenly there's a new star crashing through the atmosphere, then it would have had to break the crystal sphere. So yes, it takes a long time for them to be processed and worked out.
Our last real place is the place in which all roads, you suggest, in the 16th century led to, which is Prague and the court of Rudolf II. Dee and Brahe and Kepler, they're all here. What was the role of that extraordinary emperor in creating that place as a place of immense scientific achievement?
Yeah, he was so important, I think, and has been so undervalued by history. He was also a very strange personality. And I think, without putting modern diagnoses on a historical person, he might well have been on the autistic spectrum in some way. He was a strange and extraordinary man, really intelligent, but someone who found social interaction difficult. But he created this centre in Prague. When he became Holy Roman Emperor, he moved the capital from Vienna to Prague, and he had money at his fingertips, which none of the other rulers that we have discussed could even dream of. He just had the resources, and he also had the passion, the single-minded passion. He was absolutely and utterly focused on his collections of art and his scientists, his alchemists, and he just did it on a scale that no one else was able to. And again, the whole religious element comes into play, because Rudolf was nominally Catholic, but actually I think really struggled with religion. So Prague was a place where it was very tolerant, and you could be there and be a Protestant and you could be a Catholic. And at a time when there was a lot of religious persecution and oppression, Prague was a sort of island, a haven for people. And it was very important. That's why Kepler went there, because where he'd been working in Graz just became inhospitable to him, so he had to move. So again, we see religion forcing people to go to different places. So yes, it would have been an amazing place to be in about 1600. It really would.
I know you have a podcast called Travels Through Time where you take people back in time to a particular moment. Would you like to go to the court of Rudolf II?
I would love to, but I would like to go to all of these places. I don't know about you, but I do spend a lot of time just thinking about what would it have been like to live in the past? What would it have been like to walk down the street? What would the food have been like? That's what I just long to do. And if I got a genie that came out of a bottle and it said you have one wish, it would be to go back in time, definitely, without a question.
Our last place is a place of the imagination, which is the place that Francis Bacon writes about in his New Atlantis, Ben Salem. And the question you ask here is, where did Francis Bacon get his ideas? And I suppose I want to ask that to you with the addition of how much did the people and the places that we have considered together today pave the way for what then became called the scientific revolution?
I would argue that, of course, they paved the way. It was the development of these specialised centres where people studied. The laboratories developed during this period. That's when they started to make these specialised glass vessels for doing experiments with. And in Brahe's palace on the island of Hven, he had this huge sort of underground room with furnaces. And there's some wonderful illustrations of Greece in German princes' castles and stuff at this time. So I would say yes, hugely. And that's the story that I wanted to tell, because I really struggle with this idea that suddenly science was born in the 17th century and it all came from nothing. And there's so much focus on how Bacon's Ben Salem and Solomon's House, this research institute, there's been lots written about how it influenced into the future and all the people that looked at it and how important Bacon was in later centuries. But where did it come from? He didn't just dream it up out of nothing. But it is difficult because Bacon only went abroad once. He went to France for a brief period when he was very young. So he didn't visit any of the places that we visit in my book. But he did, I think, go to Dee's house in Mortlake. 100% sure of that, because there's an entry in Dee's library when he says, Mr. Bacon came to my house. And it must be that Mr. Bacon for various different reasons, which I go into. But he would have heard about these other places. There were huge connections between Hven, because James I had actually been there and visited when he was picking up his bride, Princess Anne of Denmark.
That's the Scandinavian island we talked about for Tycho Brahe on,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, exactly. So he'd been there, and obviously there was lots of connection between those two places because James's wife was Danish. And there were also lots of connections between the court in Prague. So I'm sure that he would have had plenty of descriptions and been able to speak to people who'd been to these places. But yes, that's my argument, is that a lot of the so-called originality of Bacon actually comes from the 16th century and from the period that he was born out of.
Well, thank you so much for sharing it with us today and giving us a sense that these centres of learning, which have been excluded from the history of science, these people and their developments who have not formed part of the kind of canon of this is where science started, need to be reconsidered. And the first place people can do that is by picking up a copy of your new book, Inside the Stargazer's Palace. Thank you, Violet, so much for your time. It's been really fun. And your book is enormously enjoyable, and I recommend it to my listeners. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Susanna. Thank you for having me on.
And thanks to you for listening to Not Just the Tudors from History Hit. And also to my researcher, Alice Smith, and my producer, Rob Weinberg. We are always eager to hear from you, so do drop us a line at notjustthetudors@historyhit.com or on X, formerly known as Twitter, @notjusttudors. And please remember to follow Not Just the Tudors wherever you get your podcasts, so you get each new episode as soon as it's released.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
History is full of extraordinary people, the Tudors being just a handful. In my latest film on History Hit, we meet Bess of Hardwick and go inside the incredible house that she built, a house that defines the elegance and grandeur of the Elizabethan age, a house fit for a woman who climbed to the top of the Tudor social ladder. To find out more about the life of Bess and many more fascinating figures from the past, sign up via the link in the description with the code TUDORS for an exclusive discount.